Back together again, you and I, on Friday, September 10th, 2021, on Connecticut Today. Our guests on the program, all with observations regarding the 20-year observance of the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks. New York attorney Michael Barish spoke to us about the 9/11 Victims Fund. He's one of the prominent attorneys in the area that is still handling claims related to that federal money. Author Seth David Radwell joined us to talk about his new book, which focuses on the schisms in American culture and whether or not transplanting democracy or our way of government to countries like Afghanistan since 9/11 makes any sense. In the 5 o'clock hour, a friend of mine, retired North Haven firefighter Kurt Andrews, joined the program 20 years ago on September 11th, 2001, in the hours immediately after the attacks on the Twin Towers. Kurt was among the thousands of firefighters coming in from all over to help New York City. Guest today, attorney Michael Barish joins us. He's a 9/11 legal advocate. He's represented more than 25,000 9/11 victims and their families, including Officer James Zadroga. He is the gentleman for whom the 9/11 Health and Compensation Act was named, and retired Deputy FDNY Chief Richard Hollis, who was one of the first responders on the scene the day of the attacks coming up 20 years ago tomorrow. Michael, hi, it's Paul at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Hi, it's so good to hear from you, and I appreciate you following this story and helping me spread the word.
Yeah, talk about this, Michael. Are there still issues here, Michael, with people getting sick and having health problems as we approach 20 years out from this, and the families? Talk a little about this.
The Department of Justice announced this week that 4,600 people have now died from 9/11 toxic illnesses compared to the 2,966 people who died on 9/11. So most definitely, 9/11 did not end on 9/11. People continue to get sick. They continue to die. And it's not just first responders.
Now talk about that, Michael. What do you mean? How is it illustrated that we're not just talking about the brave men and women of the FDNY and the NYPD that went in there? How far does this go?
Well, we all know about the 343 firefighters that died that day and the 60 police officers. My heart goes out to their families. They were the bravest of the brave. You know, while my office is two blocks from Ground Zero, I was running uptown while these guys with the sirens blazing are coming downtown towards the burning towers. But when the EPA assured us that the air was safe to breathe, look, they wanted to reopen Wall Street. I get it. But we all wanted to do our part to show that we were supporting the country. So we came back to work also. My law firm is just two blocks away from Ground Zero. They've now linked 68 cancers. So, look, we were breathing the same toxins. We'd get out of the subway. All your listeners who were commuters, they know exactly what I'm talking about. And there were thousands of people from Connecticut, you know, working on Wall Street. They were all breathing that toxic dust. In my law firm, I only had 15 people at the time, Paul. Liana died at age 47 of breast cancer. My paralegal Dennis, also at 47, died of kidney cancer. I'm a prostate cancer survivor. My secretary Barbara has lymphoma. Two others have skin cancer. All of us have respiratory problems. I'm sure this is the same story you hear at every small office, which is why I am encouraging everybody, register now in the free nationwide World Trade Center health program. Register in the Victim Compensation Fund. And if you know anybody who worked downtown whose loved one passed away, make sure that they have registered, because this is really financial security for their family. I mean, if you wanted to really sum it all up, there were about 500,000 people in the 9/11 community. We know that there are 100,000 of them were firefighters and cops from every state, by the way. They came from all over, mostly from New York, of course. But then there were 400,000 downtown office workers, students, teachers, and downtown residents. Well, only 8% of the non-responders have enrolled in the health program, while over 80% of the responders have enrolled because their unions have done a great job telling them. So I so appreciate you, Paul, helping me spread the word to the civilians. Help is available. Access what you are entitled to.
Yeah, Michael. Michael, we're going to come back, take a very quick break here for Traffic and Weather Together. We'll find out how they can register. Of course, we have thousands of people who still to this day go into and out of New York City from Fairfield County and places here in Connecticut. Michael, hang on. Attorney Michael Barish is with us talking about what you can do to still register to make sure that you may be fairly compensated if there are medical conditions that still some 20 years later can be connected to 9/11. More with Michael Barish straight ahead. First, Traffic and Weather Together on WICC. A few more minutes with New York attorney Michael Barish, a leading legal advocate and lawyer representing thousands of 9/11 victims and their families, and had a key part in the 9/11 Health and Compensation Act, and it was named for Officer James Zadroga. Michael, talk a little about Officer Zadroga and the Compensation Act itself, if people aren't familiar with that.
So Jimmy died. James Zadroga was my client. He was an NYPD officer. He died at age 34 of pulmonary fibrosis, which is just an insidious lung disease. When he died, they did an autopsy, and in his lung tissue, they found ground glass, asbestos, lead, benzene. These are all known carcinogens. And if he had it in his lungs, so does everybody else, including the school children and the commuters. And by the way, I live in Fairfield County. I commuted down every day. And you'd get out of the subway after going to Grand Central, and the smell would just hit you. But, you know, you wanted to convince yourself that the EPA was looking out for you. And so we believed the air was safe. How foolish in hindsight. So Jimmy didn't die in vain because we used that autopsy and the statistical data when we went to Congress to get them to pass the Zadroga Health and Compensation Act, which created the World Trade Center Health Program and the Victim Compensation Fund.
Is that
you might
act-
be surprised.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say.
The most common cancers are skin cancer, prostate cancer for men, and breast cancer for women. No matter your family history, there's a presumption linking these cancers.
Is there enough money in that fund, Michael? Is it constantly replenished? Where does the money come from?
So, great question, and because I don't want anyone to feel like they're taking money away from our brave firefighters and cops, because they definitely deserve it. But thanks to John Stewart and the unions, but John in particular, who shamed Congress to do the right thing, the fund is now permanently extended. There's a $10-plus billion price tag, and that should last for the next 70 years. That's how long both these programs are open. So you're not taking money away from anyone. You're just protecting your family. So I urge all your listeners, even if you are healthy, enroll now. Because you have to prove you work downtown, and a lot of businesses are no longer in business that were around 20 years ago. So you could always get affidavits from coworkers, but how many of us keep in touch with people we worked with 20 years ago? So don't wait until you're sick. Get that proof now and protect you and your family.
How do they enroll in this fund, Michael? What do they do?
Well, I know you're going to be shocked to hear me say this,
okay,
but you don't even need a lawyer. You can go right on the Victim Compensation Fund website and enroll yourself. Now, listen, a lot of people feel it's, you know, it's well worth the 10% that we are allowed to charge by Congress's law.
Sure.
So, because there's a lot of bureaucracy and red tape.
Uh-huh.
But you can go right to the VCF website, enroll there, but you should definitely enroll in the health program as well.
Well, you talked, Michael, about making that commute, as so many people do in Fairfield County, and I make it on the weekends for see my son or to go do some part-time work in the city. And go back to what you said. I mean, first of all, how long after the attack did you go back? And talk a little more about that apprehension. You said when you got off of Grand Central, then you went downstairs to the subway, and you got off downtown, and you just knew something was wrong.
Well, those buildings were on fire for 99 days, Paul. So, you know, you're totally right. There was an apprehension, and we weren't wearing masks. I mean, we were kind of stupid. And what I was told also is these paper dust masks that we're now wearing for COVID, they wouldn't have done us any good because of the size of the particulates.
Yeah.
But we would take the, you know, go to Grand Central, switch, take the, I always used to take the 4 or the 5 right down to City Hall, and then I'd have a 5-minute walk. And then I'd have the same 5-minute walk back to the subway. And then when I'd go to lunch, every time I went outside, it reeked. And, you know, our air conditioners were probably pulling in the toxins also. You know, it's really a shame that this happened, but I do give the government credit for doing the right thing, even though it was 9 years later when they passed the Z-Roga Act.
All right, Michael, as like Michael said, only 8% of qualified civilians have registered for the federal programs offering health care protections, benefits, and compensation. So you, if your
loved one... Well, if your listeners want to... If they want to learn more, they can go to 911victims.com. There's so much information on that website. And just protect yourself. That's all I'm saying. And thank you, Paul, for helping me spread the word.
Michael, thank you. Appreciate it. Michael Barish, 9/11 legal advocate, Fairfield County resident as well. Michael, thank you. We appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right, folks. 911victims.com. 911victims.com. You can check that out. And, yeah, like I said, a dear friend of mine worked in, you know, in Lower Manhattan, the financial district, Wall Street there. And I remember at the time that, you know, in the immediate days after the attack, one of the subplots, not subplot, but one of the sub-stories in the whole thing was, well, geez, when's Wall Street going to reopen? When is the financial district going to reopen? Because, you know, there would be people on all the media outlets saying, you know, for every day it's not open, for every week it's not open. You know, there's so much American commerce and this, that, and the other that's, you know, not moving. In looking back 20 years ago, 20 years ago tomorrow, on 9/11 2001, and then looking at the days after that, a meme has popped up. In fact, it popped up on social media back then and has popped up again, and it reads something to the effect of, I wish it was 9/12 again. Not 9/11, obviously, but I wish it was 9/12 again, because we felt this and saw in manifested this overwhelming sense of togetherness as a nation because we were attacked. You know, there was never a mass attack on land ever in all the wars from a foreign power on this nation until 9/11. But 9/12, 9/13, 9/14, everybody was together, and some of us back then were saying, oh, this is it. This is going to unify the country. Well, what's happened in the 20 years since? The book is called American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. Seth Radwell, one of the co-authors, the author with a foreword by Jonathan Israel. And Seth joins us with a background in business, degrees from Harvard and Columbia. Seth, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Terrific, Paul. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. What is, Seth, what is the American schism? What are we going through right now? How would you define that?
The American schism is something that started back at our founding. As you mentioned, Paul, I'm a businessman. I've run many companies. I've spent almost my entire career in business. But I took a three-year hiatus from business to understand and to analyze why we were so divided today. What I often realize is that people say we're in bubbles, in partisan bubbles. We get our media from only one place, one side. I think we're in a time bubble. And I think it's important to look back. And what in American Schism, the book is an investigative tracing to get to the roots of our divisions. And it actually turns out that there's an incredible amount of information in our history
that plays into what you're seeing now?
Exactly. That really are the antecedents of the bitter divides you see today. And in order, my sense is, in order to address them, in order to begin healing, and as you mentioned in your prior segment, bring America together again, we need to understand where we came from. turns out that at our founding, there was a division, a competing thoughts, competing schools of thought about mm-hmm. what our nation should be. And that division, that schism that happened back then during what was known as the Enlightenment, had a huge impact not only on our founding, but on each subsequent section of our history, which the book traces through. So what the book does is it first lays out where this all came from, why it started, why we're so divided today, where its antecedents lie, uses a framework to explain that, then uses that same framework to see how it evolved over five discrete periods of our history up until today, and then lays out a plan forward, a manifesto, if you will, of mm-hmm. how we can heal our bitter divide today.
Seth Radwell is a guest. Seth, hang on. Got to do traffic and weather together here. We'll come back with more. The name of the book is American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret Healing to Our Nation. Traffic and weather together, then more with Seth straight ahead on WICC. Name of the book as we head into the 20-year observance weekend of 9/11 is American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. The foreword from Jonathan Israel, and the author is longtime business executive Seth Radwell, who's with us for a few more minutes. Seth, also, before we get back to the premises of your book, you know, America since 9/11/2001, we tried to export this nation building. We tried to take this great experiment in America and tell Afghanistan and other people in Iraq saying, hey, you really should try this because it's worked so well for us. And I think we're seeing in the past couple of weeks, Seth, that maybe it doesn't always translate through no fault of our own.
Exactly. And one of the most interesting aspects of what you just said, Paul, is that why has it been a beacon of hope to the world? It's not because of the military prowess we tried to show in Afghanistan or our dabbling in Iraq and the Middle East militarily. There are two reasons why we've been an example for the world. The first one is we are the greatest example in history of the idea of self-government. And while our government is not perfect, it is the most open, transparent, and self-governing of any nation on Earth. And the second reason why we're a beacon of hope is because American meritocracy, our model for meritocracy, means anyone who works hard and develops their own skills and abilities can succeed here, regardless of how you were born. Where you came out in the birth lottery doesn't matter. And those two ideals, neither of which are perfect, those are why we are admired and exemplified. And if we try to build on those, we will continue to be the envy of the world.
But we can't transplant those, can we? Because we tried. God knows we tried, Seth. And you know, to an extent, while we had guns pointed at the bad guys and bad girls, that kind of worked, but the minute the guns went away, it kind of didn't, or doesn't.
Exactly. And I think that's what we've learned. It seems like we've learned that over history a couple of times. But recently, I think in analysis over the long haul, we see that we can export our model of democracy and enforce it elsewhere. You know, one of the most interesting things that's happening on the global stage, Paul, is that the world is moving towards autocracy. More and more, whether it's Russia and China or Hungary and Turkey and Brazil, and our dabble with it here in the States, top-down leaders who are firm and who tend to try to expand their powers is a model that is now growing in the world. And I think we have to be really careful of that. But at the same time, to your point, we can't influence the world militarily the way we have in the past.
Name of the book is American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. You know, Seth, one thing that I always say on this show, and I've said it on these types of shows for years, no matter where I've done them, is that part of the schism that you highlight, a part of the divide I say in this country, is that we just don't take the time to take a breath and appreciate the life experiences of people who may not agree with us and why they don't agree with us. I don't think it's healthy that everyone in a red state considers everyone in a blue state to be a leftist tree hugger. And I don't think it's helpful when everyone in a blue state considers everybody in a red state to be a right-wing gun nut. I mean, that just doesn't work.
And to your point, it shows that our media model, to some degree, is broken, because my research shows in the book that 77% of Americans are part of what I call the exhausted majority.
Yes.
Meaning they're neither on the extreme left or right, and they're very frustrated and tired that the extremes have crowded out their voice. Now, what this frustrated majority believes, just to your point, is that, in fact, we have more in common than divides us. They're willing to do things that have become a dirty word, like compromise. Mm-hmm. And they recognize that the way we talk to each other over Twitter, the mudslinging and rancor and acrimony that we use in our political discourse today, is counterproductive, and it needs to change.
And Seth, it's interesting you say 77%, because I'm sitting here smiling because I often say 80%. What I mean by that is, and I often say on these shows, Seth, there are 10% of people on the right and 10% of people on the left that, no matter, Seth, whatever the current issue is, they simply scream the loudest. And
yes,
that's where all the microphones go. And I sit here and say, well, wait a minute. Could we stop, whether it's the right or left, up or down, could we stop just going immediately? And I know media organizations do this, because I've been doing this for 30 years. Seth, they're easy gets. Oh, we can get him on the right. We can get him on the left.
Right.
When, as you say, Seth, I'm guessing about 80% of the people in America is going, oh, my God, can we stop? Please.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I don't know how much time we have, Paul, but I can use examples. I mean, immigration is a great one, only because 8 years ago, we had the Gang of Eight on the Hill came up with a very detailed proposal for,
yes,
addressing some of our immigration challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was so detailed and it was such a compromise framework that neither the left or right were happy. I mean, the left was unhappy because it had controls on immigration, and the right was unhappy because it had a pathway to citizenship for dreamers. But in fact, it addressed the issues. Now, here we are 8 years later, after screaming about build walls and open borders, and we're much further away from a practical solution than we were when we had this proposal 8 years ago.
And
so I think that's a good example.
Yes, and Seth, finally, though, and I always say, and I would love to get your feelings on this, part of it is the fault of people who vote, Seth, because you would think, I'm a very restless guy. I love change. And I always say, let's experiment with something. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't mean the earth blows up. We try to do something better. Seth, I really think that part of the reason that these problems never get fixed, it's because, partially, Seth, I think on both sides, the laziness of the American voter to say, hey, you know what, that guy, he's kind of new, or that gal, she's kind of new, but I like some fresh thinking on that. For some reason, Seth, not enough of that happens in this country.
Absolutely. And what I discuss in the book, Paul, is that the political industry itself has become corrupt, in the sense that the goal of politics today is not to solve problems. But the people who hold office, often the goal is to remain in office and to keep the anxiety going, because it motivates voters to keep them in their place. And that's a shame. And that's also outlined in the book, how our political the monopoly of the establishment has really stopped political problem solving from happening.
And the name of the book is American Schism: How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. The foreword by Jonathan Israel. Our guest has been the author Seth Radwell. Seth, be good. It's been fascinating. I'd love to chat down the road. Thank you, sir. Take care.
Pleasure to be with you, Paul. I'd love to come back.
Thank you, Seth. Appreciate it. Good thoughts. Interesting book, American Schism: How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. Came out on June the 29th. We'll know what happened, obviously, 20 years ago tomorrow, a generation ago tomorrow, on September 11th of 2001, the vicious, hellacious attacks on the Pentagon in Pennsylvania and also in New York City on the Twin Towers, and the entire eventual World Trade Center complex that had to be pulled down and searched and ultimately replaced there with the Freedom Tower that stands so tall now. Thousands of men and women helping in the weeks and months that passed the attacks. But in the immediate hours, the immediate days, firefighters, first responders from all over the area scrambled down to Ground Zero, many from Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, to help in a mass influx of first responders. Among those first responders was a friend of mine who gave me good fortune of recounting his story last year, and I wanted to have him on again this year because it's valuable just to hear from someone who was down there in the hours and in the days following the attacks. Kurt Andrews is a retired firefighter from the Hamden, New Haven area, and he joins me once again. Kurt, my friend, how are you?
How are you, Paul? Great to talk to you.
Well, thanks, Kurt. I appreciate it, and thanks for doing this. I appreciate it. So tell my listeners here, as you did so well last year, and thank you for recounting this, September 11th, what happened that day? When did you learn about what happened, and how did you and thousands of others like you, Kurt, spring into action?
Well, on that particular day here, I was working from home, and about quarter of nine or so, my mother-in-law called and said, "Are you guys watching TV?" And I said, "No, we're working. I'm working." And we had just had our sixth child was born 2 months before that, and my wife had her on the bed. And so we turned on the TV, and we're watching that, and I was like, "Oh, my gosh." And then shortly thereafter, the second plane hit. And as soon as that happened, we were paged to respond to our fire stations in North Haven and to stand by. And so did that. And we had a couple of minor little alarms and things. And then about 12:30, 1 o'clock or so, we came back from a small fire, and the chief was standing in our station. And he said, "We're looking for volunteers to go down to New York. We've been asked to bring 20 folks. And so we're going to take five from each firehouse in North Haven." And I immediately raised my hand and said, "I'm in." And so I came home, grabbed stuff. He said, "Plan for 2 weeks," and grabbed some clothes and things, packed it, and stopped at the store and got some provisions. And we met at the firehouse, and there we went.
So he's telling you, your chief, "Listen, this is a volunteer thing. You're going down there and plan for 2 weeks." How much of this, Kurt, was adrenaline? How much of it was critical thinking? How much of it was, "Hey, I just know I have to do this"?
It was all of that. Firefighters are kind of whacked in the head, and you know, you have to be in order to go into those types of environments that normal folks are trying to get out of. But we also have specialized training and things. And, you know, looking at what was going on television and seeing the magnitude of it, we knew that the best fire department in the world in New York was going to need some help. And so that was part of it. And, you know, it's just a human nature thing that we all want to help if we're given the opportunity. And it sounds whacked that I say that I was blessed to be there, but I do feel blessed that I had the opportunity. As you said earlier, everybody in the country wanted to help and to do something, and we were blessed with the opportunity to actually be there.
So you're on your way down there. You're, I guess, piling down the turnpike there, and you're saying, what are you able to, now this is 20 years ago, so streaming video wasn't on phones yet, you know, technologically we weren't where we are today. How much info were you guys able to get over radios about what you were heading into?
Well, let's back up to on I-95, and we hit Bridgeport, and that, you know, you just had your traffic on, and there, you know, there's traffic stopped all over the Bridgeport Fairfield County area. But on Tuesday, September 11th of 2001, we got to Bridgeport. There was nobody on I-95 at 2 o'clock in the afternoon,
wow,
except for us headed down to New York City. Literally, there were no other cars in either direction. And we could also see the smoke from the towers as we hit Bridgeport. So, and you're right, we had no reports. We were talking amongst ourselves about being careful about voids and those types of things. And then as we got into New York City, we turned it on to one of the major New York City AM stations, and they were giving reports that they were stopping traffic on the George Washington Bridge and searching every vehicle going across for bombs, et cetera. And so we actually, our chief got off with us at the Third Avenue exit.
Mm-hmm.
If you know that, if you know the area, that's,
yeah,
right before the bridge. And there's a police station right there. And so we ended up getting a police escort from there through Harlem and then down Broadway. We had a police car in front of our five vehicles and one behind us. And I'll never forget, we were doing 70 miles an hour down Broadway,
wow,
not stopping at any of the lights.
Wow. So you get there, Kurt Andrews, and you, or maybe not when you were exactly there, but at your first sight, when you got close enough to really get a look at what had happened, and you're thinking what?
We stopped at the Javits Center, and then we were billeted down to City Hall. And I literally parked on the front lawn of New York City Hall. And the debris from the towers, and you know that's like eight blocks north, was up to our knees as we were getting out of our vehicles and things. And that was just staggering. This was paper from office building type paper that had been burned and pulverized and sheetrock dust and, you know, everything else. So it was a fine dust and was all the way up to our knees that far away from it. So just, and cars on the street going down were piled on top of each other like a B movie.
Wow. Kurt Andrews. Kurt, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Riveting story of how Kurt was among the area firefighters that volunteered, all of them, to head down there and spend days and weeks helping out at Ground Zero. We'll do traffic and weather together here. We come back on this Friday on WICC. And a few more minutes with a friend of mine, longtime friend, has actually done some radio in the past, too. Kurt Andrews, a retired firefighter from North Haven, who was among the thousands at Ground Zero 20 years ago tomorrow, streaming down to New York City and helping the recovery effort. Kurt, talk about, and I know you talked about this last year, that massive debris pile, that pile of everything there, and what you folks do, you guys and gals do, to just begin to search there looking for any signs of life.
Well, we and keep in mind, and I told you before, the we were working on the South Tower. We were working from 10 House, which is right there on Liberty Street on the south side there. And the South Tower was all of 30 feet tall. It was just a pile of debris. And so we were just literally climbing on top of it and looking through just like a hill, small hill. And just looking through voids down with flashlights and things into 5-10 foot voids down into it. About midnight or so, they brought in some camera equipment with some cables and a camera at the end of a cable that we were able to get down into the voids and look at 20 feet, 30 feet down in. We were literally on our hands and knees just crawling into this. Just looking for anybody that we possibly could find.
That, Kurt, to me, what you just said, I always find that fascinating and just frightening that you're on basically a 30-foot debris pile that just hours earlier was one of the tallest buildings on planet Earth. I mean, it is mind-boggling to think of.
I remember vividly as we turned from Broadway onto Liberty Street, and I could see the pile at the South Tower. And there was a couple of cops standing there, and I looked at him, and I still remember it like it was yesterday. I can't, but please tell me that's not the South Tower. And he said, that's it. And it was literally 30 feet tall and just staggering. And my partner that night was, I'll never forget, we were, it was probably about midnight, 1 o'clock, and we were looking down into a void, and it was about 10, 12 feet down, and my flashlight caught a pink, and I went back and forth, and then I finally focused on it, and it was a baby doll. And we looked a little bit further, and I said, oh, there's a baby doll. And I said, look over here. And we were hoping to find a kid. And there was an office chair and a gym bag that was right next to it. So the only thing we could surmise was that 12 or so feet down into this void that was 18 inches, we were in somebody's office. And we didn't find anybody, but those are three stark things that I remember.
Mm. Kurt Andrews, the guest, retired North Haven firefighter, talking about his time 20 years ago tomorrow in the latter portion of September 11th, 2001. Kurt, what about the human interaction that you were experiencing on that debris pile and around the area with first responders from New York and other parts of the Northeast?
As soon as we walked down Broadway, I'll never forget that I ran into the Garrity family from Madison, and they've since sold it to Procter & Gamble, but Garrity, the flashlights, and they had a truck down there to hand out flashlights to all of us. And we ran into a bunch of East Haven firefighters, a gentleman that became the chief a couple of years later, as we were right there on Liberty Street. And I'll never forget about 11:30 or so at night that all of a sudden we saw about 10 or 12 white helmeted FDNY firefighters. And come to find out, that was the only survivors of the command staff. And amongst themselves, because remember, Chief Gansey died when the North Tower came down, mm-hmm. and most of the leadership did. So these 10 or so battalion chiefs and assistant chiefs were deciding amongst themselves who's in charge and of the whole situation. And it was just incredible. And the last thing I'll leave you with is that we didn't have cell service down there.
Sure.
And about 5 o'clock in the morning, we were brought to a firehouse up in Greenwich Village to get a couple hours of shut eye. And we finally got some cell service. And I had a bunch of messages from the Vanacore family in North Haven. And the first one was, hey, I hear you're down there. Look for Eddie. He's in the South Tower. He's on his way out. And the next one was, we just talked to him, and he was on his way down the stairwell, and he should be, look for him around the entrance. And I'm just listening to this, and the tears are just running down my face, because the South Tower was 30 feet tall. And if they hadn't heard from him yet, I knew that there was no chance for him. And so come to find out, you know, we were not able to find him that day. And about 5 or 6 years later, they identified some pieces of Eddie Vanacore via DNA sampling. And his family was able to have a funeral for him several years later. So just crazy.
Yeah. Kurt, thank you. I know this can't be easy bringing it all back here, but I think it was valuable for my listeners, and thanking you and thanking all the first responders. Kurt Andrews, I'll see you down the road, my friend. Thanks, Kurt.
Thank you, brother.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Kurt Andrews there.